I want you to imagine the following conversation. A visitor from Mars says, I attended a soccer game, what you earthlings call soccer. And I saw a whole bunch of people kicking a ball. And the purpose was to kick the ball into a net. And they were fighting each other. And there were 50,000 people watching this. And they were all very excited. And I found this very strange. Why would people invest so much time, so much effort, so much concern, kicking a ball into a net? So I say to him, well, of course, you understand. We appreciate that the ball going into the net is not a big thing. I mean, that's not the big, you know, that's not the point of the thing, to put the ball in the net. The point of it is, they're trying to put it in, they're trying to stop them, and they're fighting it out, they're trying to figure out strategies, and the Martian says, yeah, but the strategies and the fighting is all about putting the ball into the net. Now, that's just utterly trivial. I mean, you look like adults, but we have that too on Mars, and children outgrow it by the age of 9. And then we go on to serious things like inventing new machines or exploring new continents or composing symphonies. But putting balls in nets, you know, that's very childish. And it just looks like your whole culture has just never matured. You know, you've never gotten beyond the level of children. And then he said, I have read that sometimes there are fights among the supporters of one net versus the other net. And then there are times when billions of people watch this on little boxes, you know, that's going on someplace thousands of miles away, to watch this guy kick the ball into the net and that guy kick the ball into the net. Look, you know, you guys are just either weird or childish. That's all. Then the Martian goes on to say, I also observed sailboat racing. Yacht racing. Now he says, listen, you want to get there faster, and you have motorboats. So why don't you use a motorboat? I mean, you know, you're waiting for the wind to blow you there. That's how they did it 1,000 years ago. But you are advanced enough to have motors. So why are you doing it with sails if you want to get there faster? So I tried to explain to him that the whole point of it is to do it with the sail without the motor. So he says, oh, I see. You try to do something, so you tie one hand behind your back, and then you try to do it with one hand behind your back. Isn't that dumb? What are you trying to do? It? Use all the means that are available to you. Don't, you know, tie your feet together and then try to run. What could be the point of that? Then he said, but you know, I conferred with one of our anthropologists, and he told me he has an explanation. Some people are unnerved by technology. It makes them nervous and upset and phobic. So from time to time, they revert to an older stage of history where they didn't have technology. And that's what sailboat racing does. Sailboat racing and yacht racing is for people who can't really take motors. You know, they've got to get out of motors in order to restore their mental balance. So then I began to understand it. Is the Martian missing something here? Yeah. I think the Martian is missing something here. But I hope in the way that I've described the Martian's comments, you can appreciate how he could miss it. Standing from the outside, looking in, certain things catch your eye. And you relate them to your world, to your experience, to your culture. And in relating them that way, you may not get what's going on. You may not be able to relate to what's going on because you really don't get it. You really don't know what's happening there. You don't know what it means for the people who are doing it. You don't know what part it plays in their lives, what part it plays in their goals, their self-development. You only relate it to what it would mean for you. And of course, what it would mean for you is something trivial, ridiculous, childish, immature, and that's the way you interpret it. But you're making a mistake, because for the people in their culture, it has a different meaning, a different importance, and therefore it may not be just childish and immature. Then the Martian said to me, I did a survey of work. The world doesn't provide you with free sustenance. You have to work. We have to work on Mars also. Now on Mars, everybody is expected to work. Everybody is expected to produce something. Some people pave roads, and some people raise food, and some people give massages, and some people calculate the outcome, the output, and know how much input you have and how much energy you have to use. Some people do scientific experiments. And I see that on Earth, you have people doing all those things also. But I took a trip to Washington. And in Washington, there are some very big, imposing buildings. So I wondered who's in there and what kind of work they do. And as far as I could tell, all they do is talk. That's all they do. They just talk. Can you guess what he was observing? The government. Right? All they don't produce any food. They don't pave any roads. They don't discover new medicines. They just talk. So the Martian says, I think they're getting a free ride. They're not working. They're not doing anything. They're not producing anything. They're not making anything. So I tried to explain to them, listen, we have a democracy. And in a democracy, things have to be organized and decisions have to be made. And he said, look, it sounds to me like you're just pretending. They're not raising wheat, are they? They're not tanning skins, are they? They're not paving roads, are they? Then they're not working. All this fancy talk about decisions and organizing and priorities, that's just a smokescreen. They aren't working. They aren't producing. They aren't making. They aren't building. So they're getting a free ride. I think, says the Martian, this is some kind of nobility, some kind of privileged class. You don't really believe in equality. You have a certain group of people who are getting a special deal where they don't work and they get a free ride and they're paid a reasonably good salary. And you just, this talk of democracy is just a frill. It's just a cover-up. Really, they're not working. Is the Martian right? I don't know. Maybe he is right. Maybe those guys aren't really working. But in theory, anyway, the government, the democratically elected government, is very important to secure that everybody should be able to work. That there shouldn't be chaos, and there shouldn't be injustice. There shouldn't be tyranny. And if the Martian doesn't understand that, so, he doesn't understand it. He's standing outside, and he doesn't appreciate what's going on. Again, he's referring it back to his culture, and he says to himself, if anybody on Mars would spend his whole day talking, he wouldn't eat at the end of the day. Nobody would give him any money for talking. So if you guys give these people money for talking, then you're just ignoring the fact that they're not working. Because on Mars, they wouldn't be working. This is how a person from one culture can get another culture dead wrong. Partly because he doesn't have facts about what's going on in the culture that he's observing. And partly because, even if he has the facts, they don't fit into his system of priorities in the same way. I'll give you one more example. I hope the point that I'm trying to make is obvious. And the overall point is something you all know. You all know this, especially those of you who come from South Africa. You know this very well, because you have been taught to be tolerant of all the different cultures that you have in South Africa. Just as you don't have any Hasid in there. So you weren't taught that. And it's very hard for Jews to be tolerant of other Jews. Very easy for Jews to be tolerant of Zulus, but not of other Jews. So I'm just trying to take what you all know, what you've all been taught, and try to apply it to the hard case. A person has two business opportunities. In one case, he can invest $10,000 at the end of the year, to get back $11,000. In another case, he can invest $10,000 at the end of the year, will get $15,000. Both are equally secure. Both are equally secure. Both are equally certain as a return. Now, I think people used to Western culture, there wouldn't be any question. Take the 50, why throw away $4,000? There are people in other cultures, or people who have different values even within our culture, some of the Greens, for example, who would say it's not obvious that you should take the 15th. They would start by asking, how much do you need? What do you need it for? How do you decide how much you need? Is taking the 15 going to contribute to a environmentally sustainable economy? Or is it part of an environmentally destructive economy? Are you using up more natural resources than you can replace? Or are you replacing the natural resources that you use? The idea that you're making more money for them might not even be directly relevant. If it's a question of how much I need, that would be a reason not to take the 15. If I only need 11, then it's wrong to take the 50. Just because it's more might not even be a reason in its favor. It might not be relevant. I got 11 and 15. Let's see what happens to the environment. Let's see how much I need. Let's see who's paying it and what's being taken from. And that's how I would decide. Now, when they look at much of contemporary Western culture, where the 15 is automatic, 11 or 15, 15, on to the next subject. There's nothing to discuss. To them, that is dreadfully short-sighted. It's short-sighted, it's self-destructive. You don't know how much you're shooting yourself in the foot. What does the Mishnah say in Pirkei Avos? Marba nechasi, marba daga. Oh, see, we got some scholars here. You increase your possessions, you increase your worries. When we moved to Eretz Israel, we came to Israel, we brought along an Amana refrigerator. The finest, the most advanced American refrigerator. Can you guess what happened? It broke. And the fix-it people told us, every gadget you have on your refrigerator is another thing to break. So if you live in America where you can get American service, it's not so terrible, you have American service contracts. You live in Israel where it's difficult and where the latest American thing is something which the technicians are not very familiar with. A lot of the time, your refrigerator is broken. Living in Israel, you might be better off with an Israeli refrigerator, which may not have all the gadgets, but it's ready for, it's made for this climate, it's made for this usage, and the technicians know how to fix it. Now, I'm going to apply this to the case at issue. When Jews decide to explore traditional Judaism, there's a kind of unspoken premise, an unspoken assumption. I'm a Jew, and what I'm exploring is Judaism. It ought to be reasonably familiar. It ought to be reasonably comfortable. Something that I can relate to naturally. What people don't appreciate is that general Western culture is really Christian or post-Christian, which means the general values really have their source in Christianity or in reactions to Christianity. And that often what is thought of as general value or what is thought of as religion is considerably divorced from Judaism, from Jewish sources, and from historical Jewish experience. And therefore, starting an investigation of traditional Judaism requires all of the caution and all of the sophistication of an anthropologist who knows that he is inserting himself into a foreign culture and needs all of the care that an anthropologist will use in order to understand and appreciate what it is that he's observing in this culture. And to understand it and appreciate it, what is needed is an appreciation of the facts of the local culture and the values of the local culture, the beliefs of the local culture, and the experience of the local culture. If you don't have all of those features together, so then it's impossible for you to understand what you see, and certainly impossible to evaluate it. Many years ago, a woman came to visit her son in yeshiva here in Eretz Israel. This woman had no contact with yeshivas. She was a lawyer, but she had no contact with yeshivas. And she came and she observed the boys in the Beis Medrash learning. I don't know if you've all experienced this or you've seen this, but it can get pretty intense. You know how the study goes. You have a study partner, and the name of the game is, he reads and explains, and you shoot him down. That's okay, because tomorrow you're going to read and explain, and he'll shoot you down. And that's how you do it. And the idea is to see who can survive the shooting, so you get the best possible explanation of the text. But in the meantime, most of the time is spent shooting. So this woman observed the scene, and afterwards she asked, why did they hate each other so much? Because, coming from a law education in the United States, where you study in a library, which is absolutely silent, and here are these people yelling and screaming at each other, she had no context in which to interpret what was going on. She couldn't know that these people love each other. She couldn't know that they would die for each other. She couldn't know that. All she saw was they're yelling and screaming at each other. So again, standing outside the culture, looking in, and using your experience as a reference point to understand what you see, guarantees that you're not going to understand what you see. So, for example, let's take Yom Kippur. Now, Yom Kippur, people fast an absolute fast for 25 hours. There are places, especially political fasts, where fasting means you can drink and take vitamin pills and so forth and so on. They have a whole set of relaxations. But nothing goes in the mouth for 25 hours. And there's no bathing. And the shoes are not the normal leather shoes. And if you look at people, they're very serious. They'll spend time crying and beating their breasts. What's going on? So anthropologists have a category for this. It's called self-flagellation. And the idea is people, primitive people who feel that they have angered supernatural powers will try to avoid supernatural punishment by punishing themselves, hurting themselves. That's what we call self-flagellation. Flagellation means to beat. Self-flagellation means you're beating yourself. You're beating yourself to avoid a divine beating. Presumably the divine beating will be worse. And here it is. These people, clearly, they say they have sinned. And because they sinned, their fasting has a way of causing themselves pain. Now, I'm inclined to agree that this category for anthropologists is a useful category, and there may be cultures in which this happens. But in the case of Yom Kippur, the anthropologist is missing a key fact. The key fact is that the vast majority of believing Jews who fast 25 hours on Yom Kippur experience neither hunger nor thirst. It's just not hungry and thirsty. It's just not on their minds. No one in Ne'ilah, which is the last prayer of the day, the last hour and a half of the day, looks at his watch and says, 45 minutes to the Coke, 45 minutes to the hamburger. It just doesn't happen. How could that be? So I'll give you an analogy. You're watching the Super Bowl. I know. Does that mean anything in South Africa? It's not even soccer. You know, it's only American football. You know, when you grow up, you learn that that's a game. Soccer is a joke. Football is a game. Super Bowl. And there are 2 minutes left in the game, and the score is tied, and Team A has the ball on the Team B's 40-yard line, and they're in a drive downfield. How many people are going to go out and get a Coke at that time? Nobody. Nobody. No one's going to feel thirsty. 100,000 people in the stands, and a billion people watching all over the world, and not one of them is going to be thirsty. How is that possible? How is it possible that of a billion people, not one will be thirsty? Because they're very involved in what they're watching. They're so involved in what they're watching that feelings like thirst don't become conscious. There's even a neurological explanation for this, if you care about that stuff. When you are focused on one aspect of your experience, other aspects don't come into your consciousness. The last match that I wrestled in college, I had the other guy down, and I was going for a pin. And all of a sudden, my left leg stopped pushing. And my teammates were yelling at me, "Pin him! Pin him!" And I said, I'm trying. But my left leg stopped pushing. So I won the match on points. When the match was over, I couldn't walk because I had broken the big toe on my left foot. But I didn't feel any pain. I didn't feel any pain until the match was over. After the match was over, it was excruciatingly painful. But when you're concentrating on pinning the other guy, you don't feel that pain. All serious sports has pain. But while you're involved in the competition, the pain is almost non-conscious. Because you're focusing on that aspect of your experience. Now, a Jew who on Yom Kippur thinks, I have a once-in-a-year chance to wipe the slate clean and to start over again, eating and drinking isn't, this is a little ala perek, as they say in Hebrew, and it's a little balayat. It's not part of your consciousness. It's not where your mind is. It's not where your thoughts are, where your heart is, where your emotions are. So, the anthropologist is wrong. This is not self-flagellation. It's not causing oneself pain. It's rather focusing on a certain spiritual goal, a certain spiritual issue, which then crowds out bodily concerns. It just crowds them out. And they're not there. They're not conscious. And if you know a little Hebrew, and the Pasuk says, he knew it's not Shasechem, and you take your blue book and read the translation, you shall afflict your souls. And you say, gosh, affliction sounds to me like pain. So you have to know it's a mistranslation. Ani in Hebrew means poor, impoverished. It means lacking resources. La'anos means to deprive someone or something of the natural resources. Doesn't say anything about how you're going to respond to it, how it's going to feel. So here, indeed, no food and no drink means you don't have the natural resources for the body. That doesn't say that you're going to be in pain because of it. And indeed, we don't volunteer for any other. If there were a mitzvah to be in pain in Yom Kippur, then you would have some super pious people who would lie on beds of nails, or who would turn the heat up to 95 degrees and make things very uncomfortable. There isn't such thing. Everything else should be done to be as comfortable as possible. So the idea of pain is not the idea. Though the anthropologist isn't going to appreciate it. He's going to put it on a par with really primitive cultures, where indeed they do punish themselves in order to avoid divine punishment. And therefore he's going to misinterpret what's going on in this culture. Now, there are no end of such misinterpretations. You discuss a point of Jewish law, and the insider will tell you, well, that's what it says in the Talmud. And he says it in that tone of voice, meaning, that's it. No discussion, no challenge, no debate. The Talmud said it, it's finished. It's a closed book. You say, why? So what? So the Talmud says so. No, that the Talmud was edited 1,500 years ago. Hasn't anybody thought of anything since then? Isn't it possible to, analyze otherwise? And then you'll get your anthropologist. And he'll tell you, in this culture, everyone believes that the past is better than the present. Generations are always going down. In the past, people were smarter, and they were more pious, and they were more scholarly, and they were dedicated, and more courageous. And therefore, you never criticize the past. The past is engraved in stone. It's steel. All you do at best is face new challenges because new things are invented. But the past is absolutely beyond critique. Ah! Anthropology with a capital A. It's just totally false. It's totally false. Because every book of Jewish law has exceptions and is challenged by later generations, except for the Talmud. But every other book is challenged. The Mishnah, which is the core of the Talmud, and came 300 years before. The Mishnah is not always followed. There are times when the sages of the Talmud said no to the Mishnah. Maimonides' code is not always followed. The Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law. Gosh, what could be more authoritative than the code of Jewish law, right? No. Later commentators and later authorities disagree and give contrary rulings. There are people like the Gaon of Vilna who took issue with the Rambam and with Tosfos 800 years before him. The Rambam himself took issue with the Gaonim who came 500 years before him. 300 years before him, there is no limit, theoretically, to how far back you can go to take issue and have an independent opinion. The Talmud is the only text which is different. And it's different because of specific features of the Talmud that have nothing to do with a general responsibility not to challenge the past. There is no such responsibility. So, again, without the appropriate fact, without the appropriate facts, it's not going to be understood. Many people complain. Let's take the Chumash. Let's say the Chumash is the Word of God. I'm prepared to accept that, perhaps. And therefore, if the Word of God, it's binding, it's absolute, I understand that. But then there's the oral law. The oral Torah. Why do you treat that as binding? After all, they say, the oral Torah is just a human commentary on the written Torah. No, if it's made up by human beings are fallible. And being fallible, we should be able to challenge it. Why do you treat the oral as binding, as absolute, authoritative, just as you treat the written? And the answer is that this description of the oral, maybe someone will open the window back there, but it's crossed. This description of the written, of the oral as a humanly authored commentary on the written is a mistake. The facts are a mistake. In fact, much, not all, but much of the oral came from Moses, dictated by God, just like the written is. God gave Moses a gigantic amount of information, and then he said, 5% of it I want you to write down in a book, and I'll tell you how to write the book. Letter for letter. And the rest of it, transmit orally. Well, I don't care whether it's written down or whether it's oral. If it comes from God, then it's authoritative. If it comes from God, it's valid. If it comes from God, it's binding. Once I appreciate that the oral material, some of it anyway, comes from Moses, directly from God, then of course it's going to be treated as absolutely binding. It's not going to be a matter of a human interpretation. Now, let's come to Hasidism, and in particular to the institution of Etish, and I'm going to give about 10 minutes for questions because I want to make sure that it's understood and applied. It could be that I'm not focusing on what's of everybody's concern. Hasidism is a way of implementing the Torah. If the word were not, it didn't imply a kind of triviality, I would call it a style. It's a way of being Jewish. Hasidim put on tefillin like non-Hasidim, and they keep kosher like non-Hasidim, they keep Shabbos like non-Hasidim, but the way in which they do those things sometimes varies. the thoughts that go with it, the feelings that go with it, the relative priorities between the various laws and practices can be different. Stress on community. Stress on allegiance to a leader who is a guide and an inspiration, rather than each person trying, isolated, on his own, individually, to make progress. Progress is made by an integrated community with mutual support and inspiration to make progress. But the goal is the same goal as any traditional Jew. It's just that this is a particular way of implementing traditional Judaism with its own emphasis, its own focus, its own style. To understand Hasidism would mean to have a comprehensive picture of the whole of what Judaism wants to accomplish, and then to see Hasidism more or less as an adverb. This is how this group does it. This is how they manage those things. So, for example, study of Torah is very important for every traditional Jew. But Hasidim stressed that study of Torah has to be done as a service of God, not as an intellectual pastime, and not as a means of gaining social acceptance, or leadership, or power, or authority, or reputation. One has to read it as God's word, experience it as God's word, and incorporated as God's word. That when you're studying Torah in yeshiva, you have to think about the other students also, not just about your own scholarly advancement. And that then colors the way in which it's done. For example, if you have a great new idea, how do you present it? Do you say, "Guess what I thought of?" Or might you say, "You know, I heard this from somebody, although I don't remember whom, and here's the idea." The difference is, do you get credit for it, or don't you? Does that thought even enter your mind? Should I take credit? Shouldn't I take credit? What will happen to my ego? That's what makes the study of Torah a spiritual performance, rather than just an intellectual performance. If you're in university, the number of papers that have your name on it, that's your key to fame. The more papers, the more names, the more fame. That's because they're working for fame. But that's not treating it as a spiritual exercise. So Hasidism is going to color the way in which everything is done. Now one aspect of Hasidism is to have an integrated social unit with a leader. That leader serves as inspiration. He serves as someone who gives advice, someone who helps in making difficult decisions. The extent to which he gives advice or gives direction depends upon the group and depends upon the particular individual. In some cases it's a question of advice, in some cases it's a question of direction. If that sounds to you like a person giving up his freedom, giving up his sense of responsibility, giving up his own self-direction, becoming more or less like a robot, let me remind you, even in Western culture, of the many, many institutions in which people take directions from others. Like football, where there is one player who calls the plays and everybody else carries them out, period. There is no vote on the field what should be the next play. It's just not democratic. Now maybe that's a critique of football. Maybe we should lengthen the game to 3 hours and give time for a vote on every play. Somehow I've never heard any lobby working for that. Not even the communists are working for that. And an orchestra. The conductor tells you how to play. And if you're a violinist, the first violinist, who's called the concertmaster, will tell you, play this note on an up bow. Because all the bows have to go in the same direction, otherwise it looks terrible. And he'll tell you, play the note on this string, because some notes can be played on two strings. And with this much vibrato, and with this kind of emphasis. And then, you do it. Or in sports, where you have a trainer, and he says, do these exercises and run the mile this many minutes and take a rest on this day, and so forth and so on. Or a lawyer who tells his client, we're going to make this argument today, we're going to skip that argument tomorrow, he signs this affidavit today, and so forth and so on. When you have something that's very important that you want to accomplish, and you have someone who is really advanced, has better knowledge, better experience, better judgment, better courage, better self-control, better focus, you are wise to do it his way. You want to learn to paint. So what do? If you're lucky, you become an apprentice to Picasso. You watch him, he watches you, he gives you some pointers. You pay $300 an hour, spend time with, why? Because time with Picasso will be invaluable for your career. Why? Why not do it on your own? Because he's a revolving genius, that's why. You want to become a surgeon? You have to go to medical school. And guess what? They will tell you what courses to take. You cannot decide. Oh, I like organic chemistry. That means memorizing hundreds of organic molecules. I can't see what that has to do, but I'll just skip it. No, you can't skip it. You can't be a doctor without learning organic chemistry. Because people farther down the pipe than us have decided that this is important for medicine. Now, the leader in a Hasidic group is a person who has distinguished himself. Distinguished himself in spiritual living. And spiritual leadership and spiritual guidance. And Hasidim, who care about spiritual growth, gravitate to people who have that capacity. In the Hasidic world, it says Hasidim vote with their feet. If you're not getting what lifts you up over here, and there's somebody else over there who's doing something new and which might do better for you, so you go over there. There's a fellow in Yerushalayim who started about 5 years ago. He is not a Rebbe. He declares that he's not a Rebbe. He tried to chase people away. And he has hundreds of devoted followers. Because they feel that by being with him and associating with him and joining with him, they're going up. And he's adamant that he's not a Rebbe. And he will not be a Rebbe. He made a chassid for a daughter. And he told the people, don't come in strimals. Don't come dressed as if we're a Rebbe making your way. He doesn't want that. But the people say, we need you. You inspire us. You lift us up, so we want to be with you. We want to be together with you. Well, my guess is he'll become a Rebbe. You can't help it. They'll make it. They'll push him into it. They'll force him. This is the foundation of the relationship between the Rebbe and his Hasidim. Hasidim find by associating with this person that they make spiritual progress. Now, last point, and I'm going to take questions. We don't have the temple anymore. The Talmud says the temple is gone. A man's table atones for him symbolically the way the altar did in the temple. On the altar, you burned up part of the animal. Here, if a person eats with holiness, if he eats in spiritual fashion, the table could be an altar. His eating the food could convert the food into an offering. That's what the Talmud says. Okay, that's great, but I don't think I qualify. When I eat, I'm not that elevated. But let's imagine there is such a person. Not such a person, some people. Some people who really are so spiritual that when they eat, their table becomes an altar. Now, there were certain sacrifices in the temple that were divided into three parts. One part was burnt on the altar, one part went to the Kohanim, and one part went to the person himself who brought it. That part was called Sheari Korban, the remaining parts of the sacrifice that were available to the people who brought it. Of course, the altar has to get first. But after the altar gets, so the people then also can take. Now, let's suppose you have a person whose eating is on such a high level, such a level of spirituality, that his table is like an altar. What then would be the part he leaves over? the tar he leaves over will be Sheyari Korban. They'll be the leftovers of the sacrifice that are available for others to eat. We don't have a temple. I can't bring a sacrifice to the temple. But the Talmud that I live by says that a person's table could be an altar. So when that person eats from a dish and leaves over, what's left over is, for me, symbolically, the equivalent of the leftovers of a sacrifice. So I have an opportunity at that moment to fulfill an idea of the Torah, which I don't have any other opportunity to fulfill. By the way, if you like, the origin of this idea, we could see 2 weeks ago in the reading of the Torah, when Joseph has the banquet with his brothers, and he provides Jewish food for them, food that the Egyptians wouldn't eat. He had his chefs provide special food for them. And then it says he sent them portions from his own table. His own table of the Egyptian ruler. Now they had plenty of food. They had the food that he prepared for them, the Jewish food. Why did he send them portions also? Because they were the remainders of what he was eating. And you have the first example of giving over from your own to somebody else. Now that is one of the ideas of a tish. One of the ideas is to take the remainders. Now you understand, these people, when they go to a tish Friday night to a rebbe, they've all gone home and eaten at their own houses. They've all finished their meal with their family. They don't come 4 hours later to the synagogue, starving to death, and then fighting over little minute pieces of fish. That's not what's happened. The whole thing is symbolic. To an outsider, I've been told, it looks like people fighting over fish. But if you had a sharp eye and a critical intelligence, instead of reacting like the New York Times, you would ask yourself, what happens after they fight to the fish? What happens? Does the guy who didn't get punch the guy who did get? Trip him up? Knock him down? Does he elbow him out of the way? What happens? Do you see any tension, any violence, any aggressiveness in their relationships other than fighting for the fish? Indeed. What happens after a soccer game? Does the losing team go and beat up the winning team? Okay, sometimes I guess. So, especially if there's been a foul and they're worried about it. But usually, these two teams that are fighting, when I went out to wrestle, the coach told me, when you go out onto that mat, you have one thought in your mind. I'm going to kill him! That's the thought. But of course, afterwards, you shake hands. You know, we're competitors in the same sport, and we respect each other. So someone sees us fighting on the mat, would think that we are mortal enemies. Or not, but that's how you fight. You fight as if the person is a mortal enemy, and afterwards you shake hands. So, if you watch the rest of the relationships between the people in the group, you see that it's not the kind of relationship that you may have imagined, and it's certainly not what's typified by fighting for the fish. It's a matter of, in their minds and in their culture, it's a matter of showing the preciousness and the importance of the institution and showing that I'm willing to sacrifice for it and I'm willing to make an effort to get it. And it's no more than that. Okay. Questions? Yeah.
What's the root cause? I mean, it seems like the people that were heading that, I've heard it being Nishma in some ways. I want to know, what does that mean? It's not even like actually being such against another group and it being Nishma. Yeah.
Okay. You know, I have to confess here that anyone to whom you ask this question is going to be hard put to give an objective answer. You know, the history of the Misnagdim and the Hasidim is told in two ways. The Hasidim say that since now, the Hasidim are accepted, and the Misnagdim will daven in their shuls and eat at their tables and marry their children. So obviously we were right. It's just the opposition was wrong. And the Misnagdim will tell you that the early Hasidic movement really was going off, and it was only the opposition of the Misnagdim that kept them on track. Had it not been for the Misnagdim, they would have gone totally off track. Okay, that depends on who you ask about the history, right? Now find somebody who is in neither group. He doesn't know the history, so he can't give you an opinion. Either it's a matter of misinterpreting, that the opponents misinterpreted what was going on, or there were tendencies in the Hasidim that really were taking them off, and the opponents identified them, and indeed did succeed in holding them back, and therefore saved them. There was a considerable amount of misunderstanding on both sides. The Gaon of Vilna, who authored the ban on the Hasidim, his own chief disciple, the Chaim Volozhiner, didn't sign the ban. So of course, the Gaon of Vilna carried enormous weight and enormous authority, but for some reason his own chief disciple didn't sign it. So it certainly wasn't agreed upon by everybody. And whereas it did cause splits in European communities for some decades, in less than a century, the splits began to heal, and as I say, today, it's hard to see any real opposition. Now, some people tell the following story to illustrate this idea. They say, once upon a time, there was a very rich man. He had two sons. One son liked fleshes, and one son liked milk. So he built two kitchens, a meat kitchen and a milk kitchen, and his son ate in the kitchen that he liked. Then the man lost all his money, and all the children had to eat was potatoes. But the fleshy son ate his potatoes in the fleshy kitchen, and the milky son ate his potatoes in the milky kitchen. Of course, potatoes you can eat anywhere you like. It doesn't matter. Out of bad habit. You know, they kept it up. It's hard for us to appreciate what the issues were for people whose scholarly level and whose spiritual level was considerably higher than ours. It's hard for us to appreciate what the dispute was about. But Dessler has in his writings the statement that it wasn't a matter of halacha, and it wasn't a matter of philosophy, and it wasn't a matter of Kabbalah. It was a very tiny matter of priorities and two things that you've never heard of. So it's hard for us to really understand. But it really is a matter of historical interest only, because today that kind of opposition doesn't exist anymore. Okay, a native South African.
If the Rebbe is supposed to be someone who's the most spiritual that you like follow, and like you're saying, that people just follow him, and how can it be hereditary? How do you?
Well, and this is the last question I have time for. First of all, hereditary as an assignment of positions of authority and leadership is central to the Torah itself. The high priest goes to the oldest son of the high priest if he's worthy. The position of king goes to the oldest son of the king if he's worthy. So it is with all positions of communal authority. This is something which is endemic to the Torah itself. It's not something which the Hasidim invented. And by the way, look into the way yeshivas go down through the generations. And you'll often find that it's the son and the son-in-law of the Rosh Yeshiva who take over when he's gone. Right? And I think there is some logic here. After all, a person who grows up in the house of a great leader, who watches his father operating, who hears his father's discussions, and then may ask his father, look, you did this in this case, and that in that occasion, why did you do it? Who is going to have more input? Who's going to have more experience in this function than someone who's lived with it from childhood? Now, he might not have the natural talents, and in such cases, it doesn't happen. In Hasidic lines, you'll often have son-in-law rather than a son, or a grandson rather than a son, because the son wasn't material to do that. It isn't always that way. But other things being equal, that's what you would expect. The person who grew up in the house of the king, and who observed the king, and understood the activities of the king, will be a better candidate to be king than somebody for whom it's brand new, and has to learn it from scratch. Why do people get elected to presidents who've already been in Congress? Usually, or governors. Why not just somebody from the street? They said, well, he had no experience in being a leader of a large body of people, so why should that be somebody without experience? Here's a person with maximum experience. So other things being equal, the preference will go here. If other things aren't equal, then we'll go elsewhere. Okay, time for another question.
Oh, yeah. Come on.